Section 9 of Orlando by Virginia Woolf. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose, as long as Legamus is credited. Chapter 4, Part 1. With some of the guineas left from the sale of the 10th pearl on her string, Orlando bought herself a complete outfit of such clothes as women then wore, and it was in the dress of a young Englishwoman of rank that she now sat on the deck of the Enamoured Lady. It is a strange fact, but a true one, that up to this moment she had scarcely given her sex a thought. Perhaps the Turkish trousers which she had hitherto worn had done something to distract her thoughts, and the gipsy women, except in one or two important particulars, differ very little from the gipsy men. At any rate, it was not until she felt the coil of skirts about her legs, and the captain offered, with the greatest politeness, to have an awning spread for her on deck, that she realized with a start the penalties and the privileges of her position. But that start was not of the kind that might have been expected. It was not caused, that is to say, simply and solely by the thought of her chastity, and how she could preserve it. In normal circumstances, a lovely young woman alone would have thought of nothing else. The whole edifice of female government is based on that foundation-stone. Chastity is their jewel, their centre-piece, which they run mad to protect, and die when ravished of. But if one has been a man for 30 years or so, and an ambassador into the bargain, if one has held a queen in one's arms, and one or two other ladies, if report be true, of less exalted rank, if one has married a Rosina Pepita, and so on, one does not perhaps give such a very great start about that. Orlando's start was of a very complicated kind, and not to be summed up in a trice. Nobody, indeed, ever accused her of being one of those quick wits who run to the end of things in a minute. It took her the entire length of the voyage to moralize out the meaning of her start, and so, at her own pace, we will follow her. "Lord," she thought, when she had recovered from her start, stretching herself out at length under her awning, "this is a pleasant, lazy way of life, to be sure. But," she thought, giving her legs a kick, "these skirts are plaguy things to have about one's heels. Yet the stuff, flowered paduasoy, is the loveliest in the world. Never have I seen my own skin"—here she laid her hand on her knee—"look to such advantage as now. Could I, however, leap overboard and swim in clothes like these? No. Therefore I should have to trust to the protection of a blue jacket. Do I object to that? Now do I?" she wondered, here encountering the first knot in the smooth skein of her argument. Dinner came before she had untied it, and then it was the captain himself, Captain Nicholas Benedict Bartolus, a sea-captain of distinguished aspect, who did it for her as he helped her to a slice of corned beef. "A little of the fat, ma'am," he asked. "Let me cut you just the tiniest little slice the size of your fingernail." At those words a delicious tremor ran through her frame. Birds sang, the torrents rushed. It recalled the feeling of indescribable pleasure with which she had first seen Sasha hundreds of years ago. Then she had pursued, now she fled. Which is the greater ecstasy, the man's or the woman's, and are they not perhaps the same? "No," she thought, "this is the most delicious," thanking the captain but refusing, "to refuse and see him frown." Well, she would, if he wished it, have the very thinnest, smallest sliver in the world. This was the most delicious of all, to yield and see him smile. "For nothing," she thought, regaining her couch on deck and continuing the argument, "is more heavenly than to resist and to yield and resist. Surely it throws the spirit into such a rapture as nothing else can. So that I'm not sure," she continued, "that I won't throw myself overboard for the mere pleasure of being rescued by a blue jacket after all." It must be remembered that she was like a child entering into a possession of a pleasance or toy cupboard. Her arguments would not commend themselves to mature women who have had the run of it all their lives. "but what used we young fellows in the cockpit of the Mary Rose to say about a woman who threw herself overboard for the pleasure of being rescued by a blue jacket?" she said. "We had a word for them. Ah, I have it." But we must omit that word. It was disrespectful in the extreme, and passing strange on a lady's lips. "Lord, Lord!" she cried again at the conclusion of her thoughts. "Must I then begin to respect the opinion of the other sex, however monstrous I think it? If I wear skirts, if I can't swim, if I have to be rescued by a blue jacket, by God," she cried, "I must!" Upon which a gloom fell over her. Candid by nature, and averse to all kinds of equivocation, to tell lies bored her. It seemed to her a roundabout way of going to work. Yet, she reflected, the flowered paduasoy, the pleasure of being rescued by a blue jacket, if these were only to be obtained by roundabout ways, roundabout one must go, she supposed. She remembered how, as a young man, she had insisted that women must be obedient, chaste, scented, and exquisitely apparelled. "Now I shall have to pay in my own person for those desires," she reflected. "For women are not, judging by my own short experience of the sex, obedient, chaste, scented, and exquisitely apparelled by nature. They can only attain these graces, without which they may enjoy none of the delights of life, by the most tedious discipline. There's the hairdressing," she thought. "That alone will take an hour of my morning. There's looking in the looking-glass, another hour. There's staying and lacing. There's washing and powdering. There's changing from silk to lace and from lace to paduasoy. There's being chaste year in, year out." Here she tossed her foot impatiently and showed an inch or two of calf. A sailor, on the mast, who happened to look down at the moment, started so violently that he missed his footing, and only saved himself by the skin of his teeth. "If the sight of my ankles means death to an honest fellow, who, no doubt, has a wife and family to support, I must, in all humanity, keep them covered," Orlando thought. Yet her legs were among her chiefest beauties, and she fell to thinking what an odd pass we have come to, when all a woman's beauty has to be kept covered, lest a sailor may fall from a masthead. "A pox on them," she said, realizing for the first time what, in other circumstances, she would have been taught as a child, that is to say, the sacred responsibilities of womanhood. "And that's the last oath I shall ever be able to swear," she thought, "once I set foot on English soil. And I shall never be able to crack a man over the head, or tell him he lies in his teeth, or draw my sword and run him through the body, or sit among my peers, or wear a coronet, or walk in procession, or sentence a man to death, or lead an army, or prance down Whitehall on a charger, or wear 72 different medals on my breast. All I can do, once I set foot on English soil, is to pour out tea and ask my lords how they like it. Do you take sugar? Do you take cream?" And, mincing out the words, she was horrified to perceive how low an opinion she was forming of the other sex, the manly, to which it had once been her pride to belong. "To fall from a masthead," she thought, "because you see a woman's ankles. To dress up like a Guy Fawkes and parade the streets, so that women may praise you. To deny a woman teaching lest she may laugh at you. To be the slave of the frailest chit in petticoats, and yet to go about as if you were the lords of creation. Heavens," she thought, "what fools they make of us! What fools we are!" And here it would seem, from some ambiguity in her terms, that she was censuring both sexes equally, as if she belonged to neither. And indeed, for the time being, she seemed to vacillate. She was man, she was woman, she knew the secrets, shared the weaknesses of each. It was a most bewildering and whirligig state of mind to be in. The comforts of ignorance seemed utterly denied her. She was a feather blown on the gale. Thus it is no great wonder, as she pitted one sex against the other, and found each alternately full of the most deplorable infirmities, and was not sure to which she belonged, it was no great wonder that she was about to cry out that she would return to Turkey and become a gypsy again. When the anchor fell with a great splash into the sea, the sails came tumbling on deck, and she perceived, so sunk had she been in thought that she had seen nothing for several days, that the ship was anchored off the coast of Italy. The captain at once sent to ask the honour of her company ashore with him in the longboat. When she returned the next morning, she stretched herself on her couch under the awning, and arranged her draperies with the greatest decorum about her ankles. "Ignorant and poor as we are compared with the other sex," she thought, continuing the sentence which she had left unfinished the other day. "Armed with every weapon as they are, while they debar us even from a knowledge of the alphabet." And from these opening words it is plain that something had happened during the night to give her a push towards the female sex, for she was speaking more as a woman speaks than as a man, though with a sort of content after all. "Still, they fall from the masthead." Here she gave a great yawn and fell asleep. When she woke, the ship was sailing before a fair breeze, so near the shore that towns on the cliff's edge seemed only kept from slipping into the water by the interposition of some great rock or the twisted roots of some ancient olive tree. The scent of oranges, wafted from a million trees heavy with the fruit, reached her on deck. A score of blue dolphins, twisting their tails, leapt high now and again into the air. Stretching her arms out, arms, she had learnt already, have no such fatal effects as legs, she thanked heaven that she was not prancing down Whitehall on a war-horse, nor even sentencing a man to death. "Better is it," she thought, "to be clothed with poverty and ignorance, which are the dark garments of the female sex. Better to leave the rule and discipline of the world to others. Better be quit of martial ambition, the love of power, and all the other manly desires. If so, one can more fully enjoy the most exalted raptures known to the human spirit, which are," she said aloud, as her habit was when deeply moved, "contemplation, solitude, love." "Praise God that I'm a woman," she cried, and was about to run into extreme folly, than which none is more distressing in woman or man either, of being proud of her sex, when she passed over the singular word which, for all we can do to put it in its place, has crept in at the end of the last sentence. "Love." "Love," said Orlando. Instantly, such is its impetuosity, love took human shape. Such is its pride. For where other thoughts are content to remain abstract, none will satisfy this one but to put on flesh and blood, mantilla and petticoats, hose and jerkin. And as all Orlando's loves had been women, now, through the culpable laggardry of the human frame to adapt itself to convention, though she herself was a woman, it was still a woman she loved. And if the consciousness of being the same sex had any effect at all, it was to quicken and deepen those feelings which she had had as a man. For now a thousand hints and mysteries became plain to her that were then dark. Now the obscurity, which divides the sexes and lets linger innumerable impurities in its gloom, was removed. And if there is anything in what the poet says about truth and beauty, this affection gained in beauty what it lost in falsity. "At last," she cried, "she knew Sasha as she was, and in the ardour of this discovery, and in the pursuit of all those treasures which were now revealed, she was so rapt and enchanted that it was as if a cannon-ball had exploded at her ear, when a man's voice said, 'Permit me, madam.' A man's hand raised her to her feet, and the fingers of a man with a three-masted sailing-ship tattooed on the middle finger pointed to the horizon. 'The cliffs of England, ma'am,' said the captain, and he raised the hand which had pointed at the sky to the salute." Orlando now gave a second start, even more violent than the first. "Christ Jesus!" she cried. Happily, the sight of her native land after long absence excused both start and exclamation, or she would have been hard put to it to explain to Captain Bartolus the raging and conflicting emotions which now boiled within her. How tell him that she, who now trembled on his arm, had been a duke and an ambassador? How explain to him that she, who had been lapped like a lily in folds of paduasoy, had hacked heads off, and lain with loose women among treasure-sacks in the holds of pirate ships on summer nights, when the tulips were abloom and the bees buzzing off Wapping Old Stairs? Not even to herself could she explain the giant start she gave, as the resolute right hand of the sea-captain indicated the cliffs of the British Isles. "To refuse and to yield," she murmured, "how delightful! To pursue and to conquer, how august! To perceive and to reason, how sublime!" Not one of these words, so coupled together, seemed to her wrong. Nevertheless, as the chalky cliffs loomed nearer, she felt culpable, dishonoured, unchaste, which, for one who had never given the matter a thought, was strange. Closer and closer they drew, till the samphire gatherers, hanging halfway down the cliff, were plain to the naked eye. And watching them, she felt, scampering up and down within her, like some derisive ghost who in another instant will pick up her skirts and flaunt out of sight, Sasha the Lost, Sasha the Memory, whose reality she had proved just now so surprisingly. Sasha, she felt, mopping and mowing and making all sorts of disrespectful gestures towards the cliffs and the samphire-gatherers. And when the sailors began chanting, "So good-bye and adieu to you, ladies of Spain," the words echoed in Orlando's sad heart, and she felt that however much landing there meant comfort, meant opulence, meant consequence and state, for she would doubtless pick up some noble prince and reign, his consort, over half Yorkshire. Still, if it meant conventionality, meant slavery, meant deceit, meant denying her love, fettering her limbs, pursing her lips and restraining her tongue, then she would turn about with the ship and set sail once more for the gypsies. Among the hurry of these thoughts, however, there soon rose, like a dome of smooth white marble, something which, whether fact or fancy, was so impressive to her fevered imagination that she settled upon it, as one has seen a swarm of vibrant dragonflies alight, with apparent satisfaction, upon the glass bell which shelters some tender vegetable. The form of it, by the hazard of fancy, recalled that earliest, most persistent memory, the man with the big forehead in Twitchett's sitting-room, the man who sat writing, or rather looking, but certainly not at her, for he never seemed to see her poised there in all her finery, lovely boy though she must have been, she could not deny it. And whenever she thought of him, the thought spread round it, like the risen moon on turbulent waters, a sheet of silver calm. Now her hand went to her bosom, the other was still in the captain's keeping, where the pages of her poem were hidden safe. It might have been a talisman that she kept there. The distraction of sex, which hers was, and what it meant, subsided. She thought now only of the glory of poetry, and the great lines of Marlowe, Shakespeare, Ben Jonson, Milton began booming and reverberating, as if a golden clapper beat against a golden bell in the cathedral tower which was her mind. The truth was that the image of the marble dome, which her eyes had first discovered so faintly that it suggested a poet's forehead, and thus started a flock of irrelevant ideas, was no figment, but a reality. And as the ship advanced down the Thames before a favouring gale, the image with all its associations gave place to the truth, and revealed it as nothing more, and nothing less, than the dome of a vast cathedral rising among a fretwork of white spires. "St. Paul's," said Captain Bartolus, who stood by her side. "The Tower of London," he continued, "Greenwich Hospital, erected in memory of Queen Mary by her husband, His Late Majesty William the Third. Westminster Abbey, the Houses of Parliament." As he spoke, each of these famous buildings rose to view. It was a fine September morning. A myriad of little watercraft plied from bank to bank. Rarely has a gayer or more interesting spectacle presented itself to the gaze of a returned traveller. Orlando hung over the prow, absorbed in wonder. Her eyes had been used too long to savages and nature, not to be entranced by these urban glories. That, then, was the dome of St. Paul's, which Mr. Wren had built during her absence. Nearby, a shock of golden hair burst from a pillar. Captain Bartolus was at her side to inform her that that was the monument. There had been a plague and a fire during her absence, he said. Do what she could to restrain them, the tears came to her eyes, until, remembering that it is becoming in a woman to weep, she let them flow. Here, she thought, had been the great carnival. Here, where the waves slapped briskly, had stood the royal pavilion. Here she had first met Sasha. About here, she looked down into the sparkling waters, one had been used to see the frozen bumboat woman with her apples on her lap. All that splendour and corruption was gone. Gone too was the dark night, the monstrous downpour, the violent surges of the flood. Here, where yellow icebergs had raced, circling, with a crew of terror-stricken wretches on top, a covey of swans floated, orgulous, undulant, superb. London itself had completely changed since she had last seen it. Then, she remembered, it had been a huddle of little black, beetle-browed houses. The heads of rebels had grinned on pikes at Temple Bar. The cobbled pavements had reeked of garbage and ordure. Now, as the ship sailed past Wapping, she caught glimpses of broad and orderly thoroughfares. Stately coaches drawn by teams of well-fed horses stood at the doors of houses whose bow windows, whose plate glass, whose polished knockers, testified to the wealth and modest dignity of the dwellers within. Ladies in flowered silk, she put the captain's glass to her eye, walked on raised footpaths. Citizens in broidered coats took snuff at street corners under lampposts. She caught sight of a variety of painted signs swinging in the breeze, and could form a rapid notion from what was painted on them, of the tobacco, of the stuff, of the silk, of the gold, of the silverware, of the gloves, of the perfumes, and of a thousand other articles which were sold within. Nor could she do more, as the ship sailed to its anchorage by London Bridge, than glance at coffee-house windows, where, on balconies, since the weather was fine, a great number of decent citizens sat at ease, with china dishes in front of them, clay pipes by their sides, while one among them read from a news sheet, and was frequently interrupted by the laughter or the comments of the others. Were these taverns? Were these wits? Were these poets? She asked of Captain Bartolus, who obligingly informed her that even now, if she turned her head a little to the left and looked along the line of his first finger, so, they were passing the cocoa tree, where, yes, there he was, one might see Mr. Addison taking his coffee, the other two gentlemen. There, ma'am, a little to the right of the lamp-post, one of them humped, t'other much the same as you or me. Were Mr. Dryden and Mr. Pope? Sad dogs, said the captain, by which he meant that they were papists, but men of parts none the less, he added, hurrying aft to superintend the arrangements for landing. The captain must have been mistaken, as a reference to any textbook of literature will show, but the mistake was a kindly one, and so we let it stand. Addison, Dryden, Pope, Orlando repeated, as if the words were an incantation. For one moment she saw the high mountains above Brusa. The next she had set her foot upon her native shore. End of section 9.